From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Nobel Peace Prize was awarded today to the International Campaign to Ban Landmines and its coordinator, Jody Williams. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from Dr. Chris Yanu, a war surgeon who has treated hundreds of landmine victims. Also from the archives, an interview with director Robert Wise. His films include West Side Story, The Sound of Music, The Setup, Odds Against Tomorrow, and Curse of the Cat People. Wise also edited Citizen Kane. The Mill Valley Film Festival in California is paying tribute to him this week and next. David Bianculli reviews the new TV series Gene Roddenberry's Earth, Final Conflict. And film critic John Powers reviews Boogie Nights, the new film about the pornography industry. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A settlement has been reached in the $5 billion lawsuit between non-smoking flight attendants and the tobacco industry. The industry will establish a $300 million foundation to research and detect smoking-related diseases. From Miami, NPR Cheryl Duvall reports.
Settlement does not give any money to individual flight attendants, but it does allow them to continue to sue for individual damages. That's what the second phase of this trial would have been about. For flight attendants who worked some time ago, that means the statute of limitations on their claims has been eliminated. Attorneys for the tobacco industry call the settlement a common sense approach to resolving the suit. The flight attendants' lawyers say the industry settled out of concern that a verdict in this case would have eroded the proposed tobacco industry global settlement. Cheryl Duvall, NPR News, Miami.
The government says that prices producers paid last month increased 0.5%. The news hints at inflation, but analysts say the wholesale inflation report may not be as strong as it seems. Analysts say much of the increase came in tobacco costs and gasoline prices, and these factors may not pose a problem in coming months. The International Campaign to Ban Landmines and its American coordinator, Jody Williams, have been awarded this year's Nobel Peace Prize. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
The Peace Prize announcement was made by the Norwegian Nobel Committee in Oslo today. The International Campaign to Ban Landmines was set up in 1992 by a handful of non-governmental organizations, the aid and relief groups that provide the foot soldiers for the relief efforts in areas of the world where landmines wreak their havoc. In 5 years, the ICBL has grown to include 1,000 non-governmental organizations in nearly 60 countries. The campaign's coordinator is Jody Williams of Vermont. When Williams was informed by the Nobel Committee this morning, she told a Norwegian interviewer that she would be requesting a meeting with President Clinton and urging him to rethink his confused policy on landmines. Last month, at a conference in Oslo, 100 countries signed a treaty to ban landmines. The U.S. was not among them. Michael Goldfarb, NPR News, London.
Thousands of Mexican soldiers, military doctors, and nurses are trying to help victims of Hurricane Pauline. The worst of the damage is in the Mexican coastal resort city of Acapulco. More than 100 people were killed in flooding and mudslides triggered by the storm. President Clinton is ordering the creation of citizen advocacy boards to help people work with the Internal Revenue Service. The boards are the main feature of Mr. Clinton's legislation that reforms the tax agency, but Republicans say the plan is too little too late. They want the IRS placed under an independent management board, an idea Mr. Clinton opposes. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 21.5 points at 8,039. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is sagging on concern about higher inflation. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The report on September wholesale inflation was stronger than expected. The producer price index posted its largest increase in nearly 2 years last month, rising by 0.5%. Some analysts say that figure raises the potential for an increase in interest rates from the Federal Reserve. For that reason, the market's decline is being led by banking issues and other stocks most sensitive to changes in rates. The day's earnings news was mixed. Chrysler reported profit fell 37%. Even so, that was better than expected. At the same time, Waste Management warned that its results will fall short of expectations. I'm Doug Krisner.
Westinghouse Electric Company says it'll cut about 2,000 industrial jobs, mostly in Florida. The move comes as Westinghouse divides itself into separate industrial and broadcast businesses. About 1,300 of the cuts will be in its power generation business, most of them from unit headquarters in Orlando, Florida. Another 350 jobs will be cut from Westinghouse operations in Pittsburgh. A new study suggests that a stronger immigration policy by the United States may be producing an unexpected effect. Undocumented workers are staying longer in the United States. Study author and economist Philip Martin says because border security is now so tight, once illegal immigrants leave the United States, they find it harder to return. So they don't leave the United States at all. Again on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 21.5 points at 8,039. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 170 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Nobel Peace Prize was awarded today to the international campaign to ban landmines for working for the banning and clearing of anti-personnel mines. These mines are triggered by the weight of a footstep. They remain hidden, killing civilians long after a war has ended. An estimated 26,000 people a year are killed or maimed by anti-personnel mines. The United States is one of the countries that has not agreed to sign a treaty banning these mines. On this archive edition, we're going to hear from a war surgeon who has treated hundreds of landmine victims. Dr. Chris Yanu is medical director for the Red Cross's campaign against anti-personnel mines, which is, by the way, not affiliated with the group that won the Nobel. Dr. Yanu has treated the victims of war in Cambodia, Lebanon, Burundi, Afghanistan, and Somalia. I spoke with him in 1996 and asked him to describe the typical injuries caused by landmines.
There are two particular types of anti-personnel mines. The one is called a blast mine, and this is the sort of mine that is detonated when somebody steps on it. So there's a pressure sort of triggering mechanism, and you get an explosion. Now, the explosion causes a very rapid expansion of air through heat, and this will tear off somebody's leg. It creates what is called a traumatic amputation. Depending on the size of the explosive charge and whether the victim is a child or an adult, you may have the foot, the leg below the knee, the leg above the knee, simply blown away. Secondarily, you will have fragments, either from the casing of the mine, gravel, grass, soil, from the surrounding earth that is pushed up into the stump of what is left of the leg, or into the opposite leg, into the buttocks, the genitalia. I even operated on one fellow once who had a wound in the chest wall, in the muscles of the chest. And as I was cutting this out, I found pieces from the bones of his foot. So the foot that was pulverized by the explosion created secondary fragments, which were the bones of the foot, and these injured the victim in the muscles of the chest wall. The second type of anti-personnel mine is a fragmentation device, and this could be similar to a what looks like a hand grenade. It gives off small pieces of metal fragments, and they can be either directional and therefore cover a certain arc, or they can spread out over 360 degrees in a circle. And the injury there resembles very much what one would see with any sort of injury resulting from a mortar shell or a hand grenade. The body is peppered with multiple fragments of metal. Depending on the distance of the victim from the mine at the time of explosion, those fragments will either tear the body to shreds, penetrate more or less profoundly, injure or kill. The blast type of mine usually does not kill. There's usually not enough explosive substance in the mine to kill. It's almost purposely made to maim and not to kill.
Where did you treat the most landmine injuries during your career?
Well, I've worked both in Cambodia and in Afghanistan, and as well as in Somalia twice. Cambodia and Afghanistan are probably two of the countries in the world that have been most infested with anti-personnel mines. I spent about 8-9 months in both countries, 1991 in Cambodia, 1993 in Afghanistan. And we had hundreds of patients over the months that I was there that were maimed, wounded by anti-personnel mines.
Are injuries from anti-personnel mines particularly hard to treat?
They're very difficult to treat. They're particularly horrific, especially the blast mines. You not only have this traumatic amputation, a limb being literally torn away, you have a great deal of soiling. The blast, as I said, picks up gravel and grass and soil and so forth and pushes it up between the layers of the muscles. It's particularly difficult for the inexperienced surgeon to operate, in that the level of injury is actually much greater than what meets the naked eye to begin with. And you have to understand the pathological mechanism so that when you operate, you're transforming this dirty, contaminated, traumatic amputation into a clean surgical amputation. You have to cut far enough up, while at the same time trying to preserve as much as possible of the still healthy tissues. And if you don't know to look between the muscles in what is called the tissue planes, then you may very well miss it. If you do, then you're going to leave contaminated, very often contaminated organic material behind, and that is a recipe for gas gangrene or tetanus. So it can be very difficult. They're particularly horrific wounds. I have colleagues who have told me that when they're called in for an emergency case, they almost pray that it be a bullet injury or a fragment, a shell wound, not a mine injury. To see almost every mine injury that comes in, a blast mine injury, where the patient is disfigured. They're missing a foot, a leg, if somebody has picked it up, or the deminers, the people who try to do mine clearance. And sometimes they're not professional. They're peasants who have to grow food to feed their families. And therefore they'll go out into their rice paddies or their fields, and they will try to clear out the mines themselves. And they will lose a hand, both hands, be injured in the face, lose their vision. These are wounds that cause unnecessary suffering, superfluous injury, and very, very horrific disfiguring injuries.
Do you often find that by the time somebody gets to the hospital, their wound is already infected?
Very often. In many of these countries, and here it depends on many factors of geography and so forth, all war wounds are, by definition, dirty and contaminated. Now, if the patient takes 3 days, a couple of weeks to finally reach a hospital, that was very, very often the case in a country like Somalia. In Afghanistan, also with mountains and difficulty in transportation, you will often receive patients after 3 or 4 days time of injury. Cambodia was a bit better. The average transportation time was between 6 to 12 hours. But people will arrive with not only contaminated wood, but established infection. And we know also from our database that mine-injured patients undergo multiple operations. On the average, in war surgery, somebody was hit with a bullet. On the average, you're going to have 2 operations per patient. With mine injuries, the average is 3 to 4 operations. And if it's a mine-induced amputation, you get 4, 5, even 6 amputations or operations, because you have to keep cutting out the infected material, the devitalized material. We know that with blood transfusions as well, people who are injured with mines need 3 to 4 times as much blood.
Would you say that most of the victims of landmines that you've treated were intended victims, even if they were civilians? Is this part of the civilian population that was targeted by the people who laid the mines?
The anti-personnel mines have been used in very indiscriminate ways. So that very often what obviously was intended was waging war against, yes, the civilian population. But even if you do not use the mine in an indiscriminate way, The mind, by its very nature, is an indiscriminate weapon. Just think of it. The only weapon system that exists, where it is the victim that detonates the weapon, is a mine. There is no soldier squeezing a trigger, pushing a button. The mine is put out in the fields, in the mountains, on the riverbanks. It is the victim, and whether that victim is military, civilian, a woman, a child, a peasant, the mind by its very nature is indiscriminate. Whether there is an ongoing conflict, a ceasefire. In Central America, you have countries that knew 10 years of war in the 1980s. There is now a peace process, democratic elections, and yet there are still people falling victim to anti-personnel mines. In North Africa, in Egypt, you have mines left over from the Second World War, Rommel and the Afrika Korps and Field Marshal Montgomery. And 50 years later, you have victims to landmines. And therefore, the whole problem with anti-personnel mines is that already they cannot be targeted, since it is the victim who is going to set it off. And as a result, this is one of the major reasons that the mere existence and the use of anti-personnel mines goes contrary to some very basic fundamental principles of international humanitarian law.
Now, you worked for a while in Cambodia, which has an enormous number of landmines, though I couldn't tell you exactly how many.
they estimated between 8 to 10 million.
Wow. So did you have to be very careful all the time where you walked, or did you know where the minefields were?
Well, the areas where we could go were very circumscribed. I was there in 1991, even before the ceasefire. Since then, you had a United Nations mission and elections and so forth. But I was there before the ceasefire, and we were very, very close to the front lines, only a question of about 15, 20 miles. So even the areas where we could go at the time were very circumscribed. And then we were always told, as a matter of security, I mean, we usually rode bicycles around the village where we were working. Nonetheless, we were not allowed to go off into the fields. Small plastic water-resistant mines will be carried downstream of a river. And so even if the people tell you this area is safe, they go there every day to water their livestock, or they go to fetch water, or to do their laundry, or what have you. The next day, a mine could float downstream. And I remember well in Somalia, in 1992, in the city of Beletwane, where I was working at one point, in the middle of the town, a girl would go every day to the river to fetch water for her home. And she would go to the same spot. And one day she went down and she stepped on a mine. Now, Beletwane is about 40 kilometers from the Ethiopian border. There had been a war between Ethiopia and Somalia back in 77, 78. It rains in the mountains in Ethiopia. And here was a small, plastic, water-resistant mine that was washed down the mountain slope, into the riverbed, downstream, and landed on the banks of this town where this young girl would go down every day to the same spot, she thought in perfect safety, until one day there was a landmine waiting there for her.
Did you treat her?
I operated on her. I had to amputate her, yes.
What was the outcome?
She had an amputation below the knee. She survived the amputation, but it's not the easiest sort of thing to have to live with in a country like Somalia, which at the time was facing a horrendous famine as well.
The International Committee of the Red Cross has been keeping a data bank of the injuries that it treats at its war hospitals around the world. What have you learned from those data banks about anti-personnel mine injuries?
As I mentioned before, the extraordinary amount of work, the extra number of operations, the extra amount of blood that is needed for anti-personnel mine injuries. Let me give you an example. To treat 100 patients injured by assault rifles, bullet wounds, you need an average of 50 units of blood. Now, some cases are going to use several units, many cases will not need any blood, but the average for treating 100 patients is 50 units of blood. To treat 100 mine-injured patients, you need 120 units. more than twice as much. To treat 100 people amputated because of landmines, you need 350 units. That's 7 times as much blood. In many countries of the Third World, providing that blood in a safe and secure fashion is difficult because of the presence of various transmissible diseases: HIV, syphilis, malaria, hepatitis. All of that increases, obviously, the amount of work that is done. Hospitalization time. Most patients with a fragment wound or a bullet wound will leave the hospital after 14 or 15 days. A landmine victim, the average hospital stay is 25 days. And for a landmine amputee, it's 35 days. These are the sort of things that one sees and from analyzing our database. And it reinforces, of course, our own personal experience. I've had to operate on hundreds of landmine injured amongst thousands of patients. And for all of the statistical data that my analysis of our database gives me, I have numerous personal anecdotes of cases that I've had to treat that symbolize and signify the human reality of the suffering of these weapons.
Dr. Chris Yonu is a war surgeon and the director of the Red Cross's campaign against anti-personnel mines. Our interview was recorded last year. Another group, the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, won the Nobel Peace Prize today. Coming up, a new sci-fi TV series. This is Fresh Air. A new syndicated TV series is premiering this week called Gene Roddenberry's Earth, Final Conflict. Roddenberry is the creator of Star Trek, and his name is in the title of this new sci-fi series, even though he's been dead for 6 years. TV critic David Bianculli explains how and why and reviews the series.
Way back in the 60s, when TV producer Gene Roddenberry was making the original pilot for a proposed science fiction series named Star Trek, he cast his girlfriend in one of the leading roles, as a first officer named Number One. NBC rejected that first pilot, but when Star Trek finally went to series, that same girlfriend provided the voice of the ship's computer. She also ended up playing the regular supporting role of Nurse Christine Chapel. And eventually, she ended up marrying Gene Roddenberry. That woman is Majel Barrett, and she's still a central part of the ever-expanding Star Trek universe. On Star Trek The Next Generation and the current Deep Space Nine, she's featured as an outrageous empath named Lwaxana Troi. And on all continuing Star Trek projects, Deep Space Nine and Voyager, as well as the Star Trek films, she still provides the voice of the Federation computer. But with Gene Roddenberry's Earth, Final Conflict, she's taking her most active role yet. This time, she's one of the executive producers. Earth, Final Conflict is able to exist with Roddenberry's name in the title because he had conceived the project and written a blueprint manuscript back in 1976. The original Star Trek series had ended years before, so Roddenberry was pitching Earth Final Conflict to CBS then. He stopped work on it, though, when Paramount asked him to develop Star Trek as a feature film. And the Final Conflict manuscript was filed and forgotten until Roddenberry's widow found it last year and decided to develop it as a series. The 20-year delay has not been too kind, because other sci-fi projects presented in the interim make Final Conflict seem less fresh than it otherwise might. Its basic plot is about aliens who come to Earth promising to cure diseases and solve world hunger and other problems, but who come with a secret and more sinister agenda. A resistance movement springs up to try to fight them, and the hero of Final Conflict is a man caught in the middle. Now, basically, that's the same plot as the 1983 miniseries V, to name just one similar example. And the organic architecture and aircraft used by the aliens looks a lot like the stuff in a recent Movie Channel miniseries, Tales of a Parallel Universe. And the interdimensional space shortcuts look a lot like Jodie Foster's wild ride in Contact. And the local bar in this 21st century Earth city looks like a low-rent version of the cantina in Star Wars. and so on. There are times, though, when the ideas seem less familiar and more interesting. Kevin Kilner, who plays the hero, is implanted by the aliens with a chip in his brain that increases his intelligence and memory levels. Von Flores, as a human assistant to the aliens, sets up a simple test that demonstrates the potential of this new implant.
March 12th, 1987.
What about it?
What'd you have for lunch?
For lunch, a hot dog. How would I remember?
But you do know. Just recall it.
Sandoval, I was in junior high.
Boone. Humor me. Stay with it. Look around. Explore the memory, Boone.
Pizza. I had pizza.
It's intriguing that this show is arriving on TV at all. Whether it survives, that's another question. And if the show doesn't catch on quickly, TV fans 20 years from now will need an alien brain implant just to remember it.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the director of West Side Story, The Sound of Music, Odds Against Tomorrow, and The Setup. Robert Wise is being honored this week and next by the Mill Valley Film Festival. Also, film critic John Powers reviews Boogie Nights, a new movie that captures the porn industry's pre-video years.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. West Side Story, The Sound of Music, The Curse of the Cat People, The Body Snatcher, The Day the Earth Stood Still, Somebody Up There Likes Me, I Want to Live, The Setup, The Andromeda Strain, Odds Against Tomorrow, and Star Trek The Motion Picture were all directed by Robert Wise. And before he made those films, he won an Academy Award for editing Citizen Kane. The Mill Valley Film Festival, which is now underway in California, is paying tribute to Wise. Tomorrow night, the tribute continues with an outdoor screening of The Sound of Music in the amphitheater at the top of Mount Tamalpais. Next week, the festival will present a retrospective of Wise's films. I spoke with Robert Wise in 1989, after the release of his movie Rooftops. I asked him first about the challenge of adapting the stage musical West Side Story into a movie. In a naturalistic movie, it can look very artificial when street gangs start singing Leonard Bernstein songs and doing dances choreographed by Jerome Robbins.
Well, that was the biggest problem we faced from the beginning, and this is something that Jerry Robbins and I struggled with the most in putting on the film. You see, the stage, as you point out, the stage is not real. You're once removed from reality. You have the proscenium arch there. You're not into reality, so people can go out of dialogue into dance or out of dialogue into song without a little sense of embarrassment. Film is a very, very real medium, and it doesn't take kindly to stylization, unless it's another fantasy like, let's say, Wizard of Oz. So we struggled with that the most. I was the one that insisted that we open West Side Story on the actual streets of New York. There was no way we were going to be able to get a stylized set such as they had on the stage to work in films. And Jerry was all for it. Bob, I agree with you completely, but you've given me the biggest challenge in the whole picture to put my most stylized dancing, which is in that opening, against the most real backgrounds that we'll have. So we struggled with it. One of the reasons I came up with that helicopter opening was to give people a look at New York, a real New York, but a look they hadn't seen before, a kind of an abstract look at New York, although it was real, to help put them in the mood to accept these kids down the line a little bit dancing in the street.
And the helicopter opening you're talking about is a long aerial shot of Manhattan, and then it kind of zooms down into where the gang members are.
Right. And then Jerry did something else there, too, that when he got the kids out on the street after they went through the playground, if people recall that, they had the jets walking along, and they didn't just go into a dance. One of the kids kind of swings his arm in sort of a dance movement, and they walk along a couple more steps, and two of the guys do it. And then we got a few more steps, and then three of them do it. And before you know it, he had segued very slowly into dance on the street, and that helped very much ease us into it without that sense of embarrassment.
I'll preface this question by telling you that I love the movie and I love the choreography, but I was wondering if you ever thought, and Jerome Robbins ever thought, that people would almost make fun of the film because these tough macho gang members are breaking into really balletic choreography. I mean, it's modern dance, it's not ballet, but there's some very balletic moves in it.
Right. No, we didn't think so. It had worked wonderfully well on the stage. Nobody took any question of that, didn't take it apart. And, of course, Jerry's choreography in the show is also strong and so masculine, you know,
mm-hmm.
We thought it would work. What we had to do was what I was describing to you a while ago was to find ways to make it compatible with the realism of the screen. And I have to feel that the way the film has been received over the years, we were pretty successful in doing that.
Two of the leads in the Puerto Rican gang, George Takaris and Natalie Wood, weren't really Puerto Rican. Was it hard to find real Puerto Rican actors at the time to cast in the film?
Yes, there weren't any really that were right for those parts. We did a very exhausting search for actors, both coasts, both in New York and Los Angeles, and we interviewed and read just literally dozens of people for every role. And it finally ended up with the ones we put on the screen. I think they came off just fine. Of course, we did have Rita Moreno, who is Puerto Rican, playing playing Anita, and that worked out fine. But we were going for the best people, and since we couldn't find everybody who was supposed to be Puerto Rican, who qualified as Puerto Ricans, we had to go the other way.
What did you do to make them convincing?
Well, worked with him, and of course, George had played. Although George had played other roles on the stage, he worked on his accent, got the accent, and then in his looks, we used the darker makeup and all, and Natalie a little bit of that, and working on the accent, and sort of studying and knowing. Like, we had a lot of friends around. We did have a lot of other kids on the show in the other parts, smaller parts, who were Puerto Rican, and they spent a lot of time together, and I think they were able to pick up the kind of idiosyncratic aspects of the Puerto Rican people. You know?
Can we go back to your very early career, right after you got out of that shipping room at RKO,
right,
and you started editing?
Mm-hmm, sure.
You edited Orson Welles' film Citizen Kane.
That's right.
How much freedom did you have when you were editing that movie?
I had the same kind of freedom I had with any other director that I was working with in those days. People have questioned me about that and have thought probably Orson, being the kind of hands-on man that he was, had come to the editing room and told me where to cut. He didn't do that at all. I worked with him, as I said, like with other directors. I would get a sequence, get all the film in a sequence. I'd put it into a first cut the way I liked it, first cut the sequence, my version. I'd show it to Orson then, and he might like parts of it. He might ask for a change here or there to use a two-shot rather than a close-up or put this line in some other angle. Well, the usual process you go through between editor and director. I would make those changes, show it to him again, and that was the way it went all the way through the film. I don't think that he ever came into the editing room one time to impose himself on the actual process of editing. But, of course, he had his input in it after I had made my cuts.
That was a film that broke a lot of conventions. What do you think of as the most unconventional thing that you did in the movie?
Well, I think it was, number one, it was an unconventional film to start with. You know, you looked at those dailies every day and were kind of dumbfounded at the kind of scenes you were seeing and the compositions you were seeing, the setups, the photography. I think the area that I had the most input in was the breakfast table scene. If people recall that scene that shows, I have a series of very short little interplay pieces, the deterioration of the marriage between Kane and his wife. And the action as it now appears in the film, the timing, the rhythm of that whole piece, the speed of the whip pans that we use going from one segment to another, and where the dialogue came in preceding each piece. The whole rhythm of the piece was all developed in the cutting room. It was a brilliant idea, brilliantly shot, but the rhythm and the sense of it as it is on the screen was all developed in the editing room, and I would think that would be the major contribution.
Now, you also edited Orson Welles' film The Magnificent Ambersons. That was a film that the studio took him off of because the film was going so over budget and it was very long. And he was...
Well, that's not quite the story, no.
Okay, go ahead.
No, he wasn't taken off. He was unable to finish. He had finished his shooting on the film, and war had just started when we were still filming it. And Orson was asked shortly after Pearl Harbor Day by our government to go to South America as soon as he finished filming on Ambersons and to make a picture with the Brazilian people, to make a film down there. It was part of a good neighbor policy we had in trying to keep all the countries in South America on our side of the war. So Orson did this. He grabbed at it because he was draft age. He was only about 27 and didn't want to go in the army, so he left. So he did finish filming the picture before he went down to South America. And then later, after we had it all finished up and had bad problems at previews in which people just didn't sit still for it and laughed at it and all, Orson was unable to come back to the States and to be part of what we did to try to help the film and fix it. He was stuck down in Brazil making this film, and just no way he could get back. So he wasn't, as I say, taken off by the company. He was just not able to get back. And then I had to, along with Jack Moss, who was Orson's man on the film back here in L.A., to go ahead and finish it the best way we could to get a picture that the studio felt they could release.
Was there pressure on you from the studio to make cuts that you thought Orson Welles wouldn't have liked?
Not particularly. I don't think there was that kind of tug of war. I'd say Jack Moss was there all the time. Orson had been sent a copy of the film and sent back his thoughts on it. And I, someplace along the line, when I've lost, I had about a 36-page cable from him about suggested ideas and changes, this, that, and the other. And that was even before we'd had our previews. But we all were working for the same end, not to save as much of what Orson had done and the quality of what he had done and still get a film for which the audience would sit still, because literally they were just disastrous previews the first two or three we had.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to cut and we had to add some scenes, bridge scenes and whatnot. And I think the fact that the film has come down through the years as something of a classic in its own right means that we didn't completely vitiate everything that Orson had set out to do with the film.
My guest is film director Robert Wise. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Let's get back to our 1989 interview with Robert Wise, director of the movies West Side Story, The Sound of Music, I Want to Live, The Setup, Somebody Up There Likes Me, and The Day the Earth Stood Still.
The first film that you directed was Curse of the Cat People. This was in 1944, and it was produced by Val Lewton, who also did I Walk with a Zombie and Cat People, The Leopard Man. So after you were brought on to finish up that film, you directed The Body Snatcher, which starred Boris Karloff. This was a 1945 movie. And it's a film in which Karloff supplies a teaching doctor with freshly killed bodies for the doctor's anatomy lessons. It's a wonderful film. It's really moody and shadowy. And I was wondering, this might be unanswerable, but how you learned to get that kind of dark, shadowy, scary feeling in a film.
Well, it's part of it. Always starts with a story, and everything starts with that script and that story, and that was the nature of that piece, as well as parts of Curse of the Cat People. And Val Lewton, who was a terribly creative and talented producer, had a real knack for coming up with stories that lent themselves to doing that kind of dark, heavy, mysterious, effective kind of filming and look. These were black and white films, by the way, and that also lends itself, I think, more than even color to that sort of film noir kind of look. And we had excellent cameramen at RKO those days who specialized in kind of low-key effects and low-key lighting. And so we planned and staged and photographed that way. Lewton was very interesting. You see, he was such a contrast in his thinking to today's horror stories, which are so filled with the blood and gore and monsters and things. Lewton didn't deal in that with his films. He always felt that the greatest fear the audience has is the fear of the unknown, such as, did you hear that? Hey, what's that shadow over there? That kind of thing. That could be as scary to audiences and more than the specifics. And so that's why most of the films that Val was involved in had that kind of look and feeling that you could never really be sure what was out there behind that corner in the dark beyond what you could see.
Well, you mentioned shadows. I think the first time you see Boris Karloff, what you're really seeing is a shadow.
That's right. You just see a shadow. It's kind of scary.
Now, Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi were in this film. How did they feel about being in horror films for so long? Do you know?
I didn't talk to them too much about that. Boris was very keen about doing The Body Snatcher because if anybody in the audience knows the film, it's really a kind of an acting tour de force for him in his two or three marvelous scenes with Henry Danielle, who plays the doctor. It's a real kind of contest between the two. And Boris was very anxious to do it because he wanted to prove to the people of the business that he was an actor, not just a person to put in horror films, you know, a monster, that he was not just a monster. So that was what his concentration was on. And Lugosi came in as kind of an afterthought. He wasn't in the original script. The studio decided it would be a very good idea if they could put Lugosi and Karloff on the marquee. So Mr. Lewton, who was a very talented writer as well, added in the part of the porter that Lugosi played. And Lugosi didn't work very long, just a few days, and he was not very well. He was not well at all. I had to kind of nurse him through the part as it was. So I didn't really get into any conversations with him about how they felt, except that I knew that Boris was very anxious to shed that image and show that he could do something beyond just be a monster.
Mm-hmm. You've done so many different kinds of pictures over your career. How did you get to choose the movies? Were you chosen or did you choose most of the time?
Well, most of the scripts that I've done with stories I have been the material that have come to me. People come to me and say, I have a script, or I have this property, I have this book. I've come up with a couple of them. I found The Haunting, one of my favorite films, mm-hmm. a ghost story told in the 60s. I came up with The Sand Pebbles. I've worked on a few that haven't gotten on the screen, but most of them are either studio or independent producers or a writer might send me a script and say, hey, this is something I'm trying to get off the ground, and what do you think? Would you like to do it?
Mm-hmm. Is there a kind of movie you feel most at home directing?
I don't have a favorite. I really people have asked me that many times. Do I prefer to do musicals, adventure, drama, love stories? Whatever's the best strip. I do have a couple of no-nos. I haven't done any Westerns since the 50s. I found I didn't really enjoy doing Westerns too much, and I thought the scene had been overdone for so many years. I gave that up, and I had one venture into spectacle back in the early 50s doing Helen of Troy. And made that all in Rome, and I found I didn't enjoy that genre of film, so I've avoided that since. But other than that, it boils down to what is a very good script, what catches me up, and what do I feel is material that will make a very good movie and something that has another thing, the film, a story that has something to say, some comment to make.
Rescreening some of your early films got me to thinking about how much the use of music in movies has changed over the years. Not only the kind of music that's used, but how it's used to underscore dramatic moments.
Yes, it has changed quite a lot, of course. I think music is advancing, is changing, is used more in underscoring, putting aside the songs and that kind of treatment. I've always felt, at one time there was a kind of thinking in Hollywood, well, what do you need music in that scene for, to give a scene? I have always felt, what can music bring to a scene or a sequence? If it can bring something to it and add an element, a dimension, let's have it. So I know in my films, I'm very much for as much music as will contribute to the scenes that I'm putting up there.
Did you ever feel that you had a scene ruined by bad music or by the wrong music?
No, I don't think so. I think I've had some times when cues have been made, music cues have been made for a scene that I didn't like, and I just dropped it out. I didn't use it. I wouldn't let something go through that I felt was detrimental to a to a scene or a sequence. And occasionally you'll get a piece of music by a composer that it's already scored, and you get it in, and you just don't feel that it helps the sequence, and then you drop it out. But you don't leave it in if it's going to hurt.
Do you remember what the transition was like for you, going from black and white to color?
Yes, I see, my first color picture was kind of an adventure thing called, I think that's the first one, Destination Gobi, all shot up in the Pyramid Lakes in the desert north of Reno. And in those days, of course, we had big, tremendous three-strip cameras, you know. This was before single-strip color came in. They were big, huge, monster things to have to get around on locations, and that was an annoyance. I was fascinated by that prospect of doing something in color and seeing the difference and seeing how it had to be treated. And you found you had to get the different sort of sets of values, not only for the cameraman's lighting, but for the colors of your costumes and your sets and all of that, to get those all working right together, much more so than you did in black and white.
Was the color true? Were you pleased with the kind of color you could get?
Yes, I'm pretty much pleased with it. Of course, the old three-strip was the truest color, I guess, that we've ever had. It's a little truer than the one-strip, single-strip film. I've always felt, myself, that there's a tendency in films to have the colors be too colorful, too much color in them. And if I have a choice, I like to try to desaturate my colors a little bit in the films, because I think even though they're supposed to be an accurate reflection of what's out there, I think sometimes the whole process, well, to see the whole process of photography picks things up anyway, even in black and white. The blacks are blacker, the highlights are brighter than they are to the naked eye. So I think to counterbalance that in color, you have to, if you want real, true, authentic-looking color in your scenes, you have to desaturize it in the printing some in the lab, not let it go all out.
Since you started as a film editor and then became a director and producer, I'm curious if editing movies affected your approach as a director?
I suppose to a certain extent. You don't do it consciously, but obviously, knowing film and knowing what you can do with the film in the cutting room does affect you. Many people have the idea that if you've been a film editor and turned director, that you would shoot much less film because you would know just exactly how you want it to go together. But that's not the case, really, certainly not with me. As a former editor, you know how valuable it is to have good coverage, a lot of coverage down in that cutting room. So later on, after the picture's finished shooting, we could do a lot more if you have a lot of angles. If you take a picture out to a preview and have a bad laugh someplace in the scene, you need to cut a line out. If you have that extra angle up there on the shelf you've never used, you break it down and cut it in, it allows you to lose the line. There's just so much flexibility in the cutting room that former editors, I think, tend to shoot more film.
You've made so many movies. Do you have any favorites among them?
Not a single one. I don't know whether most directors do or not. I do know Gaz Kazan has. Yeah, I've read something where he said yes very quickly, America, but that was his own story, you know, so it was kind of autobiographical in a sense. I don't have. I've done, this was my 39th film, Rooftops. I have maybe 10 or 12 out of those that I would prefer or like better for one reason or another. You've named a number of them, West Side Story, and Sound of Music, Day of the Earth Stood Still, The Setup, Somebody Up There Likes Me, The Haunting, The Sand Pebbles with Steve McQueen, I Want to Live, if I didn't mention that, Andromeda Strain, about a dozen.
Film director Robert Wise recorded in 1989. The Mill Valley Film Festival, which is currently underway in California, is paying tribute to Wise. Here's music from the soundtrack of his film, West Side Story.
When you're a jet all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, let them do what they can. You've got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. You're home with your own, when company's expected, you're well protected. Then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you stay a jet.
Now I know Tony like I know me, and I guarantee you can count him in.
In, out, let's get cracking.
Where are you gonna find Bernardo?
It ain't safe to go into PR territory.
We had the dance tonight at the gym.
Yeah, but the gym's neutral territory.
Hey, Rab, I'm gonna make nice with him. I'm only gonna challenge him.
Great, Daddy-o.
So listen, everybody dress up sweet and sharp. Meet Tony and me at the dance at the 10. And walk tall.
We always walk tall.
We're jets.
The greatest.
When you're a jet, you're the top cat in town. You're the gold medal kid with the heavyweight crown. When you're a jet, you're the swingin'est thing. Little boy, you're a man. Little man, you're a king.
The jets are in gear. Our cylinders are clicking. The sharks will stay clear. Cause every Puerto Rican's a lousy chicken.
Here come the jets like a bat out of hell. Someone gets in our way, someone don't feel so well.
Here come the jets, little world, step aside. Better go underground, better run, better hide. We're drawing the line, so keep your nose hidden. We're hanging a sign, says visitors forbidden. And we ain't kidding.
Here come the jets, yeah.
And we're gonna beat every last bugging gang on the whole bugging street, on the whole bugging ever.
Coming up, a review of the new movie Boogie Nights. This is Fresh Air. Boogie Nights is a new movie about the porn film industry, starring Mark Wahlberg and Burt Reynolds. It's directed and written by 27-year-old Paul Thomas Anderson. Our film critic John Powers has this review.
Boogie Nights is something I thought I'd never see, an epic about hardcore pornographers. Set in the San Fernando Valley during the late 70s and early 80s, it stars Mark Wahlberg as porn actor Dirk Diggler, whose genius dangles between his legs. He's signed up by Burt Reynolds' character, Jack Horner, an adult film director who dreams of making an X-rated movie so artistic that men will stay in the theater all the way through. Soon, Dirk's making films with Horner's top star, Amber Waves, who's played by Julianne Moore, and with his surrogate daughter, Roller Girl, who always does her scenes in roller skates. In his strange way, Horner's an honorable man, and he makes Dirk part of his extended family, a collection of oddballs, scuzzoids, and essentially decent outcasts. Like everyone else in Boogie Nights, Horner finds being in the porn biz a perfectly reasonable thing to do, as is obvious when he explains himself to Dirk.
My name is Jack.
Eddie Adams.
Eddie Adams from Torrance.
Yep.
Jack Horner, filmmaker.
Really?
Yeah. I make adult films, exotic pictures.
Although it's filled with well-known faces, the movie's real star is Paul Thomas Anderson, the 27-year-old writer-director, whose debut, Hard Eight, didn't prepare me for the creative explosion of Boogie Nights, which is so sharp and funny and alive that you feel sure you're discovering a major talent. Like many young directors, Anderson shows traces of the filmmakers who've inspired him. The most obvious is Martin Scorsese, whose Goodfellas is the template for this insider's panorama of the porn biz. But if Boogie Nights' structure is derivative, the movie itself is fresh and original. Anderson interweaves half a dozen storylines, anchoring them in that era of blissful permissiveness when disco music throbbed, drugs and orgies were actually considered a road to liberation, and hipsters donned platform heels and skin-tight shirts whose fabric gave off a nacreous sheen. We see the adult movie milieu in its idiocy, casual sleaze, roach-like amorality, and this is the film's real triumph, in its fleeting moments of wounded humanity. While everyone we see is foolish or venal, cartoonish or lost, Anderson's view of them is amused, generous, and accepting. Amber may be a drug-addled porn star, but Julianne Moore's layered performance gives her an aura of maternal benevolence gone disastrously wrong. It's she who, in a moment of affection, turns Dirk on to the drugs that bring him down. In fact, the movie's a veritable lava lamp of shifting emotions, from Dirk's hilarious dream of playing a hardcore James Bond to Horner's spasm of disgusted regret when he realizes that his longtime financial backer, the Colonel, can no longer be forgiven his taste for underage girls. I can't mention this scene without noting that Reynolds' wry dignity as Horner is the best acting he's ever done. Scene by scene, Boogie Nights is so dazzling that I'm tempted to rave on about the unforgettable bits, like the nerve-wracking robbery in which a Chinese dude keeps dropping firecrackers and making everyone jump. In fact, there's so much good material here that I wish I could say the whole movie lived up to the opening hour's promise. But Anderson is still a better director than writer, and his script both meanders and occasionally feels rushed. The rise and fall structure is just too pat for lives so lewdly unconventional in their deluded pursuit of fame. Then again, the movie's final moments are so bittersweet and weird, we finally see Dirk Diggler's 13-inch penis, that such complaints feel like mere quibbles. Boogie Nights boasts so much thrilling stuff that Anderson may well supersede Quentin Tarantino as the director that most young filmmakers want to be. He has far more emotional range and depth than Tarantino, which isn't to say that his film will be more successful at the box office. For while Pulp Fiction was about something that American audiences find comfortable, namely murder, Boogie Nights deals with sex, which means that many people will find it disturbing.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive edition was produced by Roberta Shorrock. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, making movies in Hong Kong, now that China has taken over, we talk with Wong Kar-wai. His film Chungking Express was distributed in the U.S. by Quentin Tarantino, and his new film Happy Together won the Best Director Award at the Cannes Film Festival. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.